You see that, don't you? Milligan ducked, the wind from the briefcase ruffled his hair, then rose in a burst, swinging Garrett's briefcase up toward McCracken's chin. I can't, he panted. Your big head's in the way. McCracken leaned back just in time. He wobbled at the edge, recovered, and brought his briefcase down like a cudgel, narrowly missing Milligan's twisting shoulder. But the dodge had put Milligan off balance, and in the next instant, McCracken kicked the briefcase out of his hand. It went sailing out and away off the roof, and Milligan, in a desperate attempt to catch it, slipped from the edge. Even as his keen eyes scoured the wall for a handhold, Milligan heard Kate's cry of horror from somewhere across the rooftop. But his eyes were focused on a tiny section of crumbled brickwork below him, with a gap in the mortar in which some long-ago bird had built its nest. Milligan managed to thrust his hand into this gap as he fell, and his strong fingers found their grip. Twigs and lint from the destroyed nest sifted down over his face as he hung there, twisting this way and that, several feet below the rooftop. "Kate!" Milligan shouted. "Kate, I'm all right! Run! Run, Kate!" But Milligan was not all right, and Kate knew it. She had peeked out from the rooftop stairwell just in time to see him fall, and she understood the situation perfectly well. Maybe for the moment Milligan had found something to hang on to, but he was a sitting duck for McCracken, who glanced toward her with a delighted expression and called out, "Yes, do, Kate, run off now, and let the grown-up speak privately." He made a shooing motion with his hand. "I'll be along in a moment." Kate didn't budge, however. Her heart was pounding. She was boiling with anger and fear, and yet she was trying hard to think clearly, for she would need all her wits to save Milligan. Seeing her still standing there, McCracken cocked his head to the side and raised his eyebrows as if to say, "Yes? Are you really going to be so bold?" And he was smiling as if he hoped she would be. Kate flipped open her bucket. McCracken laughed and reached into his briefcase. Then Kate charged, and McCracken stopped laughing. The tin man knew the girl was talented, but he was quite unprepared for the ferocity of the attack she now unleashed upon him. Though a great expanse of rooftop lay between them, the items from her bucket that she flung at him now arrived much faster than he would have expected, and all were thrown with uncanny accuracy. First came a barrage of marbles, mere nuisances he deflected with his briefcase. But then a horseshoe magnet winged past his face, narrowly missing him. Next came a flashlight, which actually managed to knock a pencil from his hand, stinging his fingers. With a twitch of irritation, McCracken took out another pencil, more quickly this time, and whipped it toward the girl, who had already cut the distance between them by half. Clink! Went the pencil, as Kate deflected it with her bucket, and then she was on the offensive again. What came flying at McCracken next were a bottle of extra-strength glue, an almost empty roll of twine, and a slingshot. These last attacks were pathetic, however, and as McCracken batted the projectiles away, he reflected that she was running out of steam, not to mention things to throw. What was more, McCracken noticed that she was puffing hard on what appeared to be a broken whistle. It produced only a sort of thin squeal, no doubt trying, and sadly failing, to summon help. Then the girl threw the precious bucket itself. It came soaring along at such an enticingly slow speed that McCracken had time to laugh with anticipation, before smashing it sideways with his briefcase. It made a satisfying metallic crunching sound as it flew away off the roof. And now she was only 10 paces away, still coming toward him, still puffing absurdly on that broken whistle, and apparently with one last thing to throw. She lofted it now, and it flew toward his face at a pitifully slow speed, a small dark object of indeterminate substance. McCracken was tempted to snatch it out of the air just to see what it was, but it appeared somewhat oily and nasty, and so he merely tilted his head to let it fly past without soiling him. And then, suddenly, out of nowhere, something larger and far more frightening appeared, something with glistening cold eyes hurtling directly toward his face, its wickedly sharp beak and talons extended. And the colossal, elegant McCracken could not help but cry out and flap his arms and shield his face like a panicked child trying to ward off a bee. He was so completely taken aback that he almost didn't notice his briefcase being yanked from his hand. Then the moment passed, and McCracken dropped his arms. The falcon was sailing away with its piece of meat, and the girl, a clever girl, was running off with his briefcase. Halfway across the roof, she skidded to a stop, stooped to pick something up, and then calmly walked back in his direction. She was aiming Milligan's tranquilizer gun at him. McCracken's mood improved at once. He straightened up again, smoothing his tie, and said, "I'm impressed, Plucky. What a trick. Why, you have more talent than most of my men. You should be proud. Your ploy almost worked." Kate, who had indeed been feeling proud, and not a little surprised, to have gotten McCracken's briefcase away from him, and even to have gained the upper hand, felt her confidence diminish. Why had he said almost? She stopped and said, "You can keep your compliments. Now get away from the edge of the roof." "But why should I do as you say?" McCracken asked, crossing his massive arms like a petulant child. He was eyeing his briefcase. "I assume you'd prefer not to fall off when I knock you out," Kate said. "Oh, so you intend to shoot me with the dart?" "I might spare you a minute or two, if you do what I say," Kate said, cagily. "Now, why don't you take your tie off and leave it there? After I pull Milligan up, we'll decide what to do with you." "Very well," said McCracken, and with a mysterious smirk, he reached for his tie. It had taken Milligan a few moments to understand what was happening above him. But now he shouted, "Kate, run! He knows the gun's jammed! Run, Kate!" Kate blanched. "Oh, well, it has been 2 minutes, I bet. Do excuse me." And with that she turned and bolted for the stairs. Disappointed, McCracken watched her go. She really was impressively fast, even carrying his heavy briefcase. He hurried over to the edge of the roof and smiled down at Milligan, still hanging precariously by one hand. "I have to run, Milligan. The little vixen took off with my briefcase. But please do hang on if you can. I'll be back in a jiffy with something heavy to drop." Milligan started to say something, anything, to give Kate a better head start, but McCracken had already turned and run away across the rooftop. In the courtyard, Constance and the boys were crouching behind Sharp, whom they had propped into a sitting position against the wrecked desk. Their hope had been that anyone glancing out a window would be too preoccupied to look closely and spot them. It was like hiding behind a tiger to avoid lions, but at least the tiger was asleep. "That was more like 3 minutes," Constance mumbled when Kate appeared. She hadn't even opened her eyes. Kate didn't seem to hear her, though, and Constance whimpered pathetically, too miserable to repeat herself. Kate was panting hard, but there was no time to catch her breath. "We need to hide the briefcase." "What happened, Kate?" Sticky asked. "What's going on?" "Where's Milligan?" Rennie asked. "He's coming," Kate said between gasps. Then, with an apologetic look, she added, "But I think McCracken's coming first. That's why we need to—" She was interrupted by an explosion of glass and wood. What appeared to be an enormous cannonball. It was large, black, and round, had just burst through a second-floor window. The three of them went reeling backward in surprise. The object hit the ground rolling, then abruptly unfurled and straightened up, revealing itself to be a man in a dark suit. It was McCracken. He had taken a shortcut. "Hello, dumplings," McCracken said with a gap-toothed smile. Gripping the lapels of his suit coat, he flapped and shook vigorously, sending bits of glass and wood splinters flying in all directions. "Goodness, I haven't hurried so in years. But you see, I was afraid you'd be naughty and hide my briefcase." They wanted to flee, but they had Constance to consider, and Kate was so winded she was still trying to get Constance off the ground when McCracken snatched the briefcase from her. In an instant, he had reached inside and taken out his laser pointer. "If one of you would like some attention," McCracken said, wiggling the laser pointer, "please try to run away. I'll be happy to single you out." No one moved. McCracken laughed, so shy. Keeping the pointer at the ready, he glanced around the courtyard. "I need to run back up to the roof for a minute. I have some unfinished business with Milligan. But I'm afraid there's nothing proper to chain you to here, and I can't have you wandering off." He sighed. "Very well. I'm afraid it's nap time, children. I suppose I'll be carrying you later, but there's no help for it. Do line up." The children huddled together. The older ones put their arms around Constance, and they all steeled themselves and looked up at McCracken defiantly. And in looking up, Reddy saw a figure on the rooftop. At least he thought he did. He quickly lowered his gaze so as not to draw McCracken's attention, and when he glanced up again, a moment later, the figure wasn't there. He had thought, hoped, it might be Milligan. Was he so desperate that he'd imagined it? "Excellent," McCracken said. "If you hold on to one another like that, this will go much more quickly." He cocked his head, squinted, and held up two fingers as if framing them for a photograph. "Yes. Now hold it just like that." "Can't we get you in the picture, too?" Rennie said, as friskily as he could. He was trying to stall, and McCracken always seemed to enjoy bantering with his victims. "I'm touched," McCracken said, amused. Then he snapped his fingers. "I know. Perhaps we should have Pandora in the picture as well." McCracken reached into his briefcase again and took out an elegantly decorated cigar box. He gave it a shake. From inside came a squealing, snapping noise.
"Just for the record, I'm fine with not having her in the picture," Sticky put in.
"Me too," said Kate. "She sounds fussy." McCracken grinned. "Who's the fussy one?" he said. "Very well. Perhaps later, after you've had a chance to get to know her." He set the box at his feet. "Well, then, I have enjoyed our conversation, but there is work to be done for us grown-ups. Hold still, please." He began shaking his arms. It was clear there would be no more stalling. Once again they braced themselves, their eyes drawn irresistibly to McCracken's large silver shock watches, which glinted menacingly as they came clear of his shirt cuffs. And as McCracken raised his arms, holding his palms toward them, Rennie and Kate were both thinking helplessly, "Milligan, where are you? Where are you? Where are you?" As it happened, Milligan was on the roof. He had arrived there by scraping away old mortar with his utility tool to create finger holes. Painstakingly, laboriously, he had made his way up the side of that wall, inch by inch and brick by brick, only to discover that the ever-cautious McCracken had locked the metal door to the stairs. Ordinarily, this wouldn't have mattered. Milligan would have picked the lock or pried open the doors to the elevator. But his fingers, indeed his entire arms, were trembling violently from the arduous climb. It's no easy matter clinging to the side of a wall. And at the moment, Milligan could scarcely grip his utility tool, much less wield it effectively. And yet he must do something. Kate had saved him so that he could save her, and Milligan would do anything in the world not to fail her. Looking down into the courtyard, he saw McCracken lining the children up. There was no question what he meant to do. Milligan cast about for something heavy to throw.
He found various sharp pencils and other small implements, but nothing he could throw with any accuracy from this height, certainly not with his useless trembling fingers. Precious seconds had passed. Another glance into the courtyard. Now McCracken was shaking those enormous arms. He was holding up his palms. The children were cowering together. Desperately, Milligan looked about him one last time for something to throw. There was nothing. "You'd better enjoy this," Kate was saying, her teeth clenched, "because Milligan's going to make you pay pretty heavily for it." "Oh, you can be sure I'll enjoy it," McCracken said with a wink. "And why don't you just let me worry about Milligan? For now, sleep well, my little cheeries." An electric whine filled the air, and all the children closed their eyes, except Kate. It was only Kate, then, who saw McCracken suddenly flattened to the ground, struck from above by something very large indeed. Everyone heard the incredible whomp, however, and their eyes flew open to see McCracken lying unconscious before them. To their astonishment, they saw that on top of McCracken was another person, also unconscious. Milligan, having found nothing else to throw, had thrown himself. "Oh, Milligan, not again!" cried Kate, rushing to his side, as the boys stood helplessly by. Milligan's eyelids fluttered open, and his gaze settled upon Kate's face. He opened his eyes wide and blinked several times, trying to focus. Kate laid her hand against his cheek. "Why do you keep doing this? Why do you keep getting hurt?" "Bad habit," Milligan mumbled. "How's McCracken?" "You knocked him out," said Kate. "He seems to have broken his Pandora's box with his face." It was true. Bits of wire and spring were scattered all about the 10-man's huge square jaw, some of them still twitching and making weird twanging sounds. Perched in a nest of coiled wire were 2 AA batteries. Pandora had been a terrifying threat, but evidently an empty one. "Can you move?" Kate asked. Milligan thought a moment, then raised his right arm. "I can move this," he said, wincing. "But never mind about me. You need to get out of here. It's much too exposed, and I can't protect you now. Go on, Kate. I don't want to have fallen 4 stories for nothing." "We can't leave you. I'll rig something up with that broken desk." "No," Milligan said firmly. "No sledges this time. This isn't a race, Kate. It's cat and mouse. Just give me McCracken's laser pointer. Don't worry. I don't have to last long. Help is on the way. And anyway, it's you Mr. Curtin wants. He'll try to use you to bargain his way out of this. The crucial thing is for you to avoid being caught. But you'll only draw fire on me if you stay here, Kate. The safest thing for all of us is if you go." This might have been a ploy, but it did the trick. "Well, but where should we go?" Kate asked reluctantly. "Anywhere but here. Just keep moving. Don't get cornered. And don't go near the Whisperer. Do you think Constance can tell you when someone's coming?" She turned to Constance, who was curled up in a ball, shivering and whimpering. "Maybe," Kate said. "Doubtful," said Sticky. "Then keep your eyes open," Milligan said, "and your noses, too. When the other sentries arrive, the 10 men will sound an alarm. When you hear that, make your way toward the gate. But you still have to avoid being seen. Is that clear?" Kate nodded. "Oh, Milligan, it's clear, but we'll talk about how hard this was when it's all over, okay? Right now what I need from you is action, Kate." That did it. Kate kissed him and stood up quickly, and the boys wished him luck. Then they helped poor Constance onto Kate's back, and the 4 of them hurried out of the courtyard, stopping only to look back one last time at Milligan. He waved to them from where he lay, looking perfectly relaxed, as if he had just settled down for a bit of a rest, and as if it were the most natural thing in the world to be using a 10-man for a pillow. The Sorting Out.
"Let's check the gate," Rennie said when they had gone inside. "If it's clear, why not get out now?"
"We could scout it out from the roof," Sticky suggested.
"No, the elevator's jammed," Kate said. "I think Mucho and Miss Plug are in there.
I hope so anyway, because I didn't see them on the roof."
"What about the stairs?" Sticky asked.
"Too risky, don't you think?
We might get trapped up there, and there's no other way down except the way Milligan came."
"Okay, forget the stairs," Sticky said.
"Come on," Rennie said. "We'll sneak as close as we can to the gate and take a peek." And so, with their eyes peeled and their noses in the air, the society set off. Running furtively down corridor after corridor, peeking around corners before hurrying on, they found their way at last to the building's main entrance at the front of the prison complex. There was an empty lobby there, with an empty reception desk and empty dusty chairs. But the place was full of sound, shocking, enormous, violent sound, and as they crept forward to peer out through the front doors, large double doors with windows in them, like the courtyard entrances, the children already knew that the path to the gate wouldn't be clear. The incredible screeching, squealing, and banging warned of complete mayhem outside, and sure enough, looking out, they beheld a most intense and curious battle taking place. Hertz, the 10-man in the seersucker suit, was in a fight with two vehicles, spinning, running, lashing out with his necktie, which he held like a bullwhip. Hertz snarled and laughed as a sleek black van and the 10-men's fake ambulance maneuvered around him like angry elephants, roaring, charging, backing up, and blaring horns. One moment, Hertz's tie would wrap around a door handle, and he would start to yank the door open. The next, he would have to give up the attack and leap aside as the other vehicle bore down on him. The van kept sounding its horn and the ambulance its siren, apparently in an attempt to disorient him. His briefcase lay open on the ground, but the vehicles weren't giving the 10-man any chance to reach into it. The best he could do was kick it out of the way whenever one started to roll over it. Through the windows, they gaped with wide eyes and wrinkled noses. The odor of burnt rubber reached them even inside the building, trying to determine whether it would be possible to make it to the gate unnoticed. But some seconds passed before they could make any sense of the spectacle, not least because smoke from the madly spinning tires drifted in clouds over the scene, now obscuring one vehicle, now the other. But then a gust of wind momentarily cleared the air, and with a jolt they recognized the drivers of the vehicles, Rhonda and Number Two.
"Whoa," Kate said.
"They're unbelievable," said Rennie. Sticky nodded, but he was already turning away. "We can't possibly go out there, though, so what do we do?"
"Let's go out the back," Kate said, trotting past him to take the lead. "I'm getting an idea."
Again they sneaked through the empty corridors, pausing to listen at every odd sound, and at one point narrowly avoiding discovery, as two 10-men burst out of a room and walked quickly toward the front of the prison.
"Are you serious?" one was asking the other. "But wouldn't that diminish the market value?"
The other shrugged and said he only knew what he'd been told. Luckily, the children had smelled cologne in the corridor and slipped through a different doorway just in time. At last they reached the rear of the prison complex. Peeking out another set of double doors, they saw S.Q. Padalian loping along in the distance, speaking into his radio as he hurried around a corner of the building. He was carrying Garrett's briefcase, the one Milligan had dropped from the roof. Then he was gone, and save for the widespread demolition debris and the looming crane near the wall, the area seemed clear. Kate pursed her lips, listening, then led the boys toward the building's opposite corner, away from the one S.Q. had rounded. On a mound of rubble along the way, she discovered her half-crushed bucket, its flip-top dangling by a sliver of metal. She removed the flip-top with a jerk as one removes a loose tooth, and despite its poor condition, she belted it on again as a matter of principle. At the side of the building, they saw the large open-sided shed she told them about. The salamander was still there, sitting in plain view, and seemingly unattended. "Constance," Rennie whispered, as they stole toward the shed, "is anyone hiding in the salamander?" Constance snorted, shuddered, and looked up with wild eyes. Several strands of Kate's ponytail clung to her damp face. "What?" Rennie cringed, laid a finger to his lips, and repeated the question. "Who cares?" Constance muttered, and buried her face in Kate's ponytail again. It was unclear whether she'd actually been awake, but obviously she wasn't going to be of much use. Kate laid her gently on the ground and tiptoed over to inspect the salamander. With a look of relief, she motioned the boys over. "I know how to drive it," she said, "but it would be great if we could activate the noise cancellation thingy, wouldn't it? We could break out without anyone even noticing." She pointed to a complicated panel of switches and buttons. Rennie looked at Sticky. "Can you figure it out?" Sticky bent close to the panel, studying it. "I think this will do it," he said, throwing two switches and turning a dial. "It ought to..." His mouth kept moving, but no more words came out, for all sound around them ceased. It was the strangest sensation, like having one's ears plugged by invisible fingers. They looked at one another and nodded. The boys took seats on benches near the front, their movements utterly, eerily silent. Kate leaped down and retrieved Constance, then started the engine. They could feel the vibrations but heard nothing, and took the wheel. The salamander backed silently out of the shed, jerked to a stop, and eased toward the rear of the complex. As they moved along, Sticky continued to study the panel of switches. Something had caught his attention, a curious little antenna he couldn't account for, and he started to mention it to Rennie and Kate, but of course he couldn't. The salamander rounded the corner, and Kate pointed toward a section of the prison wall that seemed ready to buckle. Web-like fissures ran outward from a damaged, crumbling portion about 10 feet up. Rennie looked from the wall to the gigantic metal beam suspended from the crane nearby. He suspected Kate was right. Something had gone wrong with the crane, and that beam had struck the wall. As they drew closer, he noticed the yellow hazard tape wrapped around the operator's cab of the crane, warding people away. Kate steered the salamander in a wide path around the dangling beam. Even Kate could be sensibly cautious sometimes, then stopped and motioned for the boys to get out. With a flurry of gestures, she indicated she intended to ram the damaged wall. She had mentioned this plan earlier when they were running through the corridors, but she hadn't provided much detail, and now Rennie and Sticky responded with gestures that meant, "What about you?" Kate indicated that she intended to jump out before the collision. Moderately satisfied, Rennie and Sticky climbed down and reached up to take Constance. They carried her a safe distance away, hearing, after a dozen paces or so, the crunch of their own footsteps, and, from a distance, the continuing sounds of conflict. "It's like breaking out of a prison of silence," Rennie said. "Don't jinx us," Sticky said. "We haven't broken out of anything yet." As Kate backed up the salamander to get a good start at the wall, they did their best to make Constance comfortable on the ground. She mumbled and moaned. She was absurdly miserable, but there was little they could do for her at the moment. "By the way," Sticky muttered to Rennie, and Mr. Curtin also added, but he stopped speaking when they saw the salamander lurch forward. Kate had gunned the engine. The salamander accelerated rapidly and was soon moving so fast that the boys were horrified at the thought of Kate's leaping out of it. Then they were horrified she might not leap out at all,
for she was still at the wheel, and the wall was fast approaching. But at the last instant, she turned, ran, and leaped out the back, tumbling backward from the momentum when she hit the ground. Then she sprang up with a grin, threw out her arms, and took a bow, as if this weren't an escape attempt, but rather a spectacle put on for an appreciative audience. In truth, it was a spectacle. Even as Kate bowed, the salamander smashed into the wall behind her, sending up a great cloud of dust. The razor wire atop the wall snapped like twine and went furling away in both directions, and cinder blocks and vast chunks of cement fell down all around the salamander. The debris hammered the armored vehicle with such force that it shuddered visibly with each impact, yet so soundlessly they might have been giant wads of cotton. And then the show was over. The salamander had come to a rest with its nose jutting out on the far side of the wall. Rubble lay all around and inside it. But beyond the salamander, the boys could plainly see Stonetown River rushing past. They were seconds away from freedom. And yet, the breakout was not as quiet as they had hoped. The crash itself may have been silent, but it was instantly followed by a curious whining sound that seemed to come from two separate directions, traveling along the tops of the prison walls. Rennie and Sticky grimaced at each other, realizing what it was. All around the prison, the razor wires, vibrating from the salamander's impact, were sending out a telltale, spooky song. "Quick," Rennie said, and Sticky stooped to help him get Constance onto her feet. Kate was trotting away from the salamander, smiling with satisfaction. As soon as she could hear her footsteps, she congratulated herself. "Not bad, Kate. Now you just have to—" Her voice was cut off in mid-sentence. Startled, she glanced behind her, and a cry of fright passed soundlessly from her lips. The salamander had reversed out of the wall and was rapidly bearing down on her. Already it was so close that it filled her vision completely. She had no time to leap out of the way, and with half a second's delay, she would have been struck. But Kate didn't delay. She flung herself down and let the huge machine pass silently over her, its bulk blotting out the sun, its enormous treads churning the earth on either side. Then it was past, and leaping up, Kate saw the boys dragging Constance out of the salamander's path. "A remote control," she heard Sticky saying to Rennie. And looking past them, she saw Mr. Curtin. He sat in his wheelchair near the building's back door, his face livid with fury, manipulating a small device in his hand. "This is mine," he snarled, as the salamander rolled to a stop beside him. Evidently, he'd switched off the noise cancellation. "You are not to touch it." "Too late," said Kate simply. "And it's too late for you, too," she added, and was looking for a snappy way to elaborate, when her brain registered the familiar red helmet he was wearing. Speech failed her. Her heart, already hammering, tripled its pace. The helmet was affixed to the back of his wheelchair. Mr. Curtin had made the Whisperer portable. So this was the final adjustment Mr. Curtin had been working on, this wicked improvement on his wicked invention. And yet so much had not gone according to plan, and his expression betrayed a complicated mixture of fury, disappointment, outrage, and triumph. "You have spoiled my day, children," Mr. Curtin said sharply. "But as you can see, there is always the night. Now tell me, where has your protection gone? Can it possibly be that you have been left to fend for yourselves? Oh, dear, how unfortunate for you." "The same could be said for you," Kate retorted. "On the contrary, Miss Weatherall, I am once again in control. Come with me now, and I will spare you the gloves. I may even let you keep your memories. You shall be my defense as I track down and eliminate my enemies." "We won't do it, Mr. Curtin," Rennie said, and though he knew he should be terrified, he felt strangely unafraid. Was he just too used to being frightened? "We won't do what you say. You should know that by now." Mr. Curtin narrowed his eyes. "You prefer to be brain-swept, I see." "You might want to save your energy," Rennie said. "There are 20 more agents on their way here right now, and Milligan's already taken care of McCracken and most of your other thugs. How tired are you right now, Mr. Curtin? Do you feel strong enough to brain-sweep 20 agents?" Mr. Curtin stared hard at him. "I do not trust you in the least, Reynard." A shadow passed over his face, an expression first of doubt and then of angry wonder. "And yet, I sense you're telling the truth. There really are more agents on the way, and McCracken hasn't responded to my radio calls." "Because he's down for the count," said Sticky, stepping boldly forward, "just like Sharp, just like Crawlings and Garrett. Try calling them on the radio. Rennie's telling the truth, all right." Mr. Curtin hissed at him, and Sticky jumped back in fright. "I thank you for your suggestion, Reynard," Mr. Curtin said coldly. "Perhaps I had better save my energy. Rather than waste my whisperer on your little brains, I shall simply make use of my gloves. This is your last chance to obey. You will form a circle around me as we move—" Rennie interrupted him. "If he comes after us, scatter," he said to his friends. "He can't chase us all down. He doesn't have time." Sticky nodded, and Kate slung Constance up onto her back. They prepared to run. Mr. Curtin glared. "Your foolishness grows tiresome, Reynard. There is no need to catch all of you. One shall provide insurance enough, and the easiest to catch shall also be the most useful." Everyone knew who he meant, including Constance, who opened her bloodshot eyes long enough to bug them out at him. Then she closed them and lowered her head again, too sick even to be impertinent. Mr. Curtin snorted and looked at Kate. "Are you tired, Miss Weatherall? You look it, I'm afraid. You do indeed. And you have no chance of outrunning me. My wheelchair never tires, and you are carrying extra weight. Perhaps you should unburden yourself and make it easier on everyone." "Fat chance," Kate growled. "Even if you catch me, I'll fight you. Believe me, you won't like it." "Oh, I think I will," said Mr. Curtin dryly. He reached inside his suit coat and took out his gloves. "We'll all fight you," Sticky yelled, and he shook his fist at Mr. Curtin. Then, feeling slightly ridiculous, he coughed and lowered his arm. "He's right," Rennie said. "You may be stronger and faster, and you may have those gloves, but there are three of us and only one of you, and you have to go soon or you'll risk being caught." Mr. Curtin seemed extremely taken aback. "Risk? Caught? You dare suggest to me?" He began taking deep breaths to calm himself, and Rennie noticed that his knuckles were white from clenching the armrests of his wheelchair. Evidently, he realized that they were prepared to do what they said. They were ready to engage in a fight they would certainly lose, indeed painfully lose, in order to protect their whiny friend. And Mr. Curtin had no idea how to handle it. Rennie pressed the advantage. "This isn't about winning any more, Mr. Curtin. It's about getting away." Mr. Curtin started to reply, then cut himself off, clamping his mouth shut and staring upward at the sky. He was breathing noisily through his lumpy nose. "Your only chance," Rennie went on, "is to jump in the salamander right now and drive out through that hole in the wall. Delaying will only get you captured. It's up to you." Mr. Curtin slowly lowered his gaze to Rennie's face. "I see what you're up to," he said. "You think if I do what you suggest, I'll have to leave my whisperer behind. You think it's too heavy for me to lift into my salamander alone." He drummed his fingers on his armrests, his eyes darting back and forth. "But you can see Rennie's right," Sticky said. "If you want to have any chance of escaping, you'd better do it now." "Do not pretend to be interested in my welfare, George, and I will not feign interest in yours." Mr. Curtin was nodding to himself as if he were arriving at a decision. "I assure you, if I must make my exit, it will not be without my whisperer. It is everything I have, do you see? No, of course you do not. No matter. It is my all, and I will protect it at all costs. Therefore, at least one of you must come as my hostage."
"I think we've been through this already," Kate said, tartly. "There's no way."
But she didn't finish her thought, for Mr. Curtin had just taken out his radio.
"You think your 10 men will come help you?" Rennie said, thinking fast. "They have problems of their own."
As if to prove his point, a boom and scattered shouts rang out in the distance. For all Rennie knew, this was a worse sign for them than for Mr. Curtin. But Mr. Curtin couldn't be sure either.
"They're probably wishing they had a different employer right about now."
Mr. Curtin hesitated, offered Rennie a sardonic smile, then raised the radio and did exactly what Rennie had hoped he would do.
"SQ, come to the rear of the prison at once. At once, SQ. Do not make me—"
SQ could not have been far away, for almost immediately he appeared around the corner of the building, running at full tilt. There was nothing left to do now, Rennie thought, but hope he was right. As SQ ran up, Rennie looked him straight in the eyes.
"Don't do what he says, SQ. You know he wants to hurt us. You know he does, SQ."
Stunned, SQ drew up short, looking back and forth between Mr. Curtin and the children.
But, Mr. Curtin snapped, "but? You may not say but to me, Escupidalian."
SQ cringed and turned apologetically to the children.
"I'm sorry, you just don't understand."
"But we do understand," Kate said, shaking her head. "You want to do what's right, and you want to believe that Mr. Curtin is good.
But he isn't, SQ. Think about it. What he tells you never feels right, does it?"
I don't... SQ shifted back and forth, clutching at his head.
"We know what it's like, SQ," Sticky joined in. "Not wanting to be alone, wanting to have a family. We've all been there. But you can have that and do what's right, too. Trust your instincts, SQ."
Mr. Curtin was quaking with rage, his forehead pressed hard against the front of the Whisperer's helmet.
"SQ," he bellowed, "stop chattering with them and do as I say. This is absolutely your last chance."
"Or what?" Rennie challenged, turning on him. "You'll start removing his memories again?" SQ gaped at Mr. Curtin, whose shock was plain enough. It was the shock of having been exposed, not of having been falsely accused, and SQ saw this as clearly as anyone. After a long moment, he drew himself up and shook his head.
"No," he said. "No, I won't do it, Mr. Curtin. I won't do what you say."
Mr. Curtin's jaw dropped.
But you won't do it," SQ finished. "That's what I said."
He glanced at the salamander, then at the hole in the prison wall.
"I'll help you get away, Mr. Curtin. I don't want anything to happen to you. I'll help you escape, but I'm not touching these children."
Mr. Curtin let loose a shriek of outrage.
"Then I'll touch them," he snarled, whipping his wheelchair around, "and I'll deal with you."
The children were getting ready to bolt when the double doors banged open and someone shouted,
"Ladrotha, stop!"
Out through the doors came a frazzled Mr. Benedict, doubled over and breathing hard. His suit coat was torn, his shirt was half untucked, and in his hair were bits of red fuzz from the wig he'd worn as Mr. Rubicund. Staggering over to put himself between Mr. Curtin and the children, he panted,
"Leave them alone, Ladrotha. It's finished, anyway."
Mr. Curtin was so furious, it was a wonder he was still awake.
"How dare you tell me when anything is finished, Benedict? No, no, no. I shall tell you when it's over. And for you it is over right now."
And, flipping a switch on his wheelchair, he glared at Mr. Benedict with such hideous intensity that it was alarming even to look at his face. "Very well, Ladrotha, very well," Mr. Benedict intoned, and he turned to the children. He had recovered his breath somewhat, and with perfect calmness he said, "He's attempting to brain sweep me, I'm afraid. Now, how are you all? I see poor Constance is sick. Well, it's no surprise.
She's had quite a day, hasn't she?" The children were too astonished to answer. Not 5 paces away, Mr. Curtin was focusing on Mr. Benedict with all his might. Yet Mr. Benedict was paying him no attention whatsoever, and seemed to be feeling no ill effects. "Ask you," Mr. Benedict said, smiling warmly. "It's good to see you again. I've never quite gotten over our last difficult parting. I hope I find you well." Like the children, S.Q. was too confounded to reply. Meanwhile, Mr. Curtin had begun to sputter. His face had grown pale and glistened with sweat, and his wheelchair twitched and bucked like a spooked horse. Mr. Benedict glanced at him. "You may recall how much time I've spent in the basement lately," he said, turning back to the children. "Constance believed I was seeking a cure for my narcolepsy, and for secrecy's sake I chose not to dissuade her of this notion. But the fact is, I was working on a program that would disable the Whisperer. It was a delicate business, for I had to disguise my work. Naturally, if Ladrotha regained possession of the Whisperer, and I knew he intended to try, I didn't want him to detect the program." Behind him, Mr. Curtin gasped. "You mean you sabotaged it?" Rennie cried. "Indeed," said Mr. Benedict. "But my program didn't go into effect until, about 20 minutes ago. You can imagine my dismay when Ladrotha stole the Whisperer yesterday, having cleverly deceived me into thinking he would make the attempt today. But it has all worked out well in the end, hasn't it?" "It has?" Sticky asked, hopefully. "Certainly. Why, thanks to you children, we were able to prevent Ladrotha from obtaining the secrets he desired. And now the Whisperer is no longer a threat to anyone. His computer programs, including the self-destruct mechanism, are all wiped clean away. I'm afraid he's wearing that silly helmet for nothing." Rennie suspected that Mr. Benedict was attempting to infuriate his brother. After all, it would be easier to capture him if he fell asleep. If that was the strategy, it almost worked. Mr. Curtin's shock of disbelief was quickly overcome by fury, for the evidence was clear. The Whisperer was not responding to his mental directions. Everything, his invention, his great plans, everything was ruined, and his face had gone quite purple as this realization took hold. Still, even through the horror and anger, Mr. Curtin saw that his fate depended upon staying awake. Panting and trembling, he began turning his wheelchair in a slow circle, trying to think what to do. "Ladrotha," Mr. Benedict said quietly, "you have no one to call. Your government connections have been severed. Further orders to disrupt the city's power and communications will not be followed. Fleeing or fighting will be pointless now. And yet, a peaceful surrender may earn you some degree of mercy before the court. Are you hearing me, Ladrotha? Your best course of action is to surrender." Mr. Curtin scarcely even looked at him, but S.Q. was listening with utmost attention. And when Mr. Benedict had finished speaking, he said, "He's right, Mr. Curtin. You should turn yourself in. But don't worry, you don't have to do it alone. I'll do it with you. We can do it together." Mr. Curtin stared at S.Q. a moment, then pointed a finger at him and said, "You wish to help me, S.Q.?" S.Q. nodded emphatically. "I do." "Then move," Mr. Curtin barked, and his wheelchair suddenly shot forward. With a nimbleness no one had seen in him before, S.Q. leaped aside just in time as Mr. Curtin barreled toward the prison wall. And then he had to leap again. Indeed, they all did, for the salamander had launched into motion as well, following after Mr. Curtin like some vast creature under a spell. S.Q. stumbled, recovered his balance, then jumped up and climbed into the salamander as it passed by. "If you're going, Mr. Curtin, then I'm going with you."
"Should we try to stop them?" Kate asked. Mr. Benedict shook his head sadly.
"We already have stopped them, Kate. This is just the sorting out."
And so Mr. Benedict and the children watched the sorting out. Near the prison wall, Mr. Curtin had slowed to let the salamander catch up with him. Like a stunt rider standing in the saddle, he rose and balanced on the seat of his wheelchair, and from there he leaped over the salamander's side, smacking straight into S.Q., who had staggered forward to help him.
"They're going to crash," Rennie said, for the salamander had narrowly missed the construction crane and was headed to the right of the gap in the wall.
Mr. Curtin, however, had taken the wheel and applied the brakes, and just in time he brought the salamander to a grinding, skidding stop. With a curse they could hear even from a distance, he ordered S.Q. to give him room, then reversed the salamander to take a better angle.
Mr. Curtin's abandoned wheelchair, meanwhile, was now rolling crazily along on its own. But Mr. Curtin paid it no mind, as if the wheelchair, like everything else, was something he meant to escape from forever. Round and round it looped at greater and greater speed, until its course brought it crashing headlong into the construction crane with a violent crunch. The red helmet dropped to the ground like fruit from a tree, and a lone wheel wobbled off and twirled to rest like a spun coin. The wheelchair would never be used again, but it had not done its final damage. High above, the crane's cable slipped visibly, and the enormous metal beam began swaying back and forth. An ominous groaning echoed off the building and the prison wall. Mr. Curtin looked up in alarm as the beam's shadow passed over the salamander.
"S.Q.," he ordered, "get into the crane and grab that lever." In a flash, S.Q. had climbed into the cab of the crane, breaking through the yellow hazard tape, which now hung from him like streamers, and grabbed a large lever.
I can feel it trembling. I think it's slipping."
"Of course it's slipping, you fool," Mr. Curtin shouted. "You need only hold it until I'm through the gap."
Overhead, the beam swung back and forth, now over the gap in the wall, now over the crane itself. The groaning grew louder.
"I don't think I can," S.Q. shouted. Kate gasped and started to run forward, but Mr. Benedict, predicting this, had already grabbed her.
"You mustn't risk it," he said, his face rigid. "No matter what you do, that beam is going to fall."
Mr. Curtin had maneuvered the salamander into the gap now. He was almost to the river.
"Come, S.Q., come on, you idiot."
"But if I let go..." S.Q.'s face was a mask of fear. High above him, the beam swung and swung.
"Snakes and dogs," Mr. Curtin bellowed.
He gazed up at the swinging beam, then at S.Q., and then turned to stare at the dark river flowing past. Under the circumstances, his hesitation seemed very strange indeed. He seemed to stare a terribly long time, and as he stared, his shoulders seemed to sag, as if a great weight had settled upon them.
Perhaps, thought Rennie, standing with the others, still watching anxiously from a distance, perhaps the full force of despair had finally hit him. Hadn't he said that the Whisperer was his all? Hadn't he lost it forever? So what did that river have to offer him? If one had nothing to escape to, what did escape really mean? And then Mr. Curtin turned his back on the river, leaped from the salamander, and climbed into the cab of the crane. As he did so, a loud wailing alarm sounded from the direction of the prison gate.
"The sentries have arrived," Mr. Benedict said to the children, but Mr. Curtin seemed not even to notice. Elbowing S.Q. aside, he snatched hold of the trembling lever.
"Get into the salamander and pull it forward, S.Q. I will follow after."
"But you won't be able to. I'm stronger than you, S.Q. Now do as I say."
S.Q. leaped down from the cab and ran to the salamander. But instead of pulling it forward, he backed it out of the hole in the wall, turning it so that its back end was almost to the crane. Mr. Curtin was shouting furiously at him,
Badescu shouted even louder. Jump down and get under the salamander, then I'll drive it out. You'll be protected if the beam falls.
Mr. Curtin gaped at him as if astonished.
But of course it's going to fall, Eskew. Couldn't you tell that? And now...
He shook his head. His arms were visibly shaking with the effort of holding the lever firm.
I will not go to prison, Eskew. And yet... I am so weary of trying to control what ought to be controlled. So weary.
It's all right, Eskew called desperately. You can still be all right, Mr. Curtin. I'll help you. Just let go of the lever and jump down.
Mr. Curtin looked very tired, and almost relieved.
Gazing at Eskew, who was gazing back with a helpless, concerned expression that Mr. Curtin had never seen from anyone, at least not directed toward him, he seemed to settle something in his mind.
Yes, I suppose it's time I relinquish control. At least I can control the relinquishing.
Very well, Eskew, I'll let go of the lever. Let go and let chance take over at last.
Mr. Curtin released the lever and threw up his hands in defeat. The lever slipped, the beam dropped. But before the lever slipped and the beam dropped, Eskew, who had started moving the instant he saw what Mr. Curtin meant to do, leaped into the cab of the crane, seized him, and leaped out again, falling hard to the ground. The beam came down just as Eskew was dragging Mr. Curtin beneath the salamander. It struck the cab and the salamander both, crushing the cab like an aluminum can, and nearly flattening the salamander's sides. But when Mr. Benedict and the children came running to pull the men from the wreckage, they found them unhurt. Eskew was holding Mr. Curtin tightly, so that they had to drag the two men out together. And Mr. Curtin was cursing him, berating him, snapping at him, "You fool! You fool! You miserable unthinking!" But Rennie noticed, and so did they all, that Mr. Curtin was clinging as tightly to Eskew as Eskew was to him, and in the brief moments before his emotions sent him to sleep, Mr. Curtin's eyes expressed something quite different from the words he was uttering with such ferocity. His words were venomous, and his face was twisted with despair. Yet there was something in his eyes that might have seemed familiar in anyone except Mr. Curtin. It was relief, perhaps, or perhaps something even stronger. It might even have been hope.
Projects and Poetry. Mr. Benedict awoke with a start and ran his fingers through his rumpled hair. Glancing about, he found himself in his study chair, flanked by Rhonda and Number Two. Across the desk sat a frowning Mr. Gaines and a worried-looking Miss Argent.
"Ah," Mr. Benedict said, "you were saying, Mr. Gaines?"
"Have you already forgotten?" growled Mr. Gaines. "Apparently you found it quite humorous."
"Oh, yes," Mr. Benedict said with a smile. "You were warning me of the consequences of failing to cooperate.
I apologize. I thought we had established that the Whisperer no longer functions. So your threat to deny me access seemed like a joke."
Mr. Gaines stared at him coolly. "We thought with proper incentive you might be persuaded to restart the Whisperer."
"To do so, I would essentially have to reinvent it, Mr. Gaines, a project that would take many years and in which I have no interest."
Mr. Gaines grunted doubtfully. "We'll return to this subject later, then. Right now we have some straightforward questions, and you would be well advised, Mr. Benedict, to answer them honestly."
"I shall do my best," Mr. Benedict declared, patting the hand of Number Two, who had bristled at Mr. Gaines's words. Rhonda reached across and handed her a banana.
Why don't you ask them all together? It will be more efficient that way. Oh, and if you don't mind, please start at the end of the list and work your way backward. Changing the order of things often helps clarify my thinking." Mr. Gaines rolled his